WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Aaron McRuder, writes and draws the syndicated comic strip The Boondocks. This year, Rolling Stone described him as one of the five young political cartoonists bringing the noise of dissent to America. The Boondocks has been controversial in some newspapers because McRuder takes on issues pertaining to race, politics, and pop culture. The strip is carried daily in 350 newspapers. McRuder is now working on a TV series and a movie based on his Boondocks characters, and he has a new collection of his strips called A Right to be Hostile. The Boondocks is about two brothers who have moved with their grandfather from an inner-city neighborhood to a largely white suburb. The older brother, Huey Freeman, named after the Black Panther Huey P. Newton, is something of a political and social critic, even though he's still a preteener. His younger brother, Riley, wants to have the thug look, like the rappers and action heroes he emulates, but he worries he might be too cute to look tough. McRuder is critical of pop culture's focus on the thug life. He thinks African-American pop culture, rap in particular, has gotten stuck and has stopped evolving.
When gangster rap started, there was more balance. You know, in the early 90s, very late 80s, early 90s, when it first came out and got popular, there was a bunch of different type of hip-hop music that was out. And it's not that, you know, gangster rap in and of itself is this horrible thing. It's just when you're inundated with it, and kids are inundated with it nonstop, and there's really not a lot of alternatives that are presented to them, it becomes slightly problematic. You know, not just for the idea of content and what it's saying, as much as just the idea that, you know, we have really become, we black people have sort of lost our creativity, which, you know, we're kind of known for and we basically pride ourselves for. That's basically gone away. And that to me is a greater concern than just the content issues and the violence and the misogyny and all that stuff.
Well, this is a theme that you kind of cover a lot in Boondocks. I mean, in one strip, a character says, "In the past 10 years, we've seen the near total disintegration of black political and social leadership. That means the single largest influence on black America's self-image is popular culture, music, TV, and films. To ensure the ongoing mental enslavement of the black man, black TV and films must remain racially degrading, intellectually insulting, and creatively stagnant." Now, of course, that's the kind of conspiracy version of what you're saying.
Right. I'm not sure if there's, you know, three or four guys in a room planning all this out. But nevertheless, I think, you know, we're doing pretty bad right now. And, you know, it does bother me because it is true that there really is no social or political leadership in this. So all of this stuff, even though it's just entertainment, does take on a greater importance, particularly in black communities. You know, a lot of white people are into hip hop, but they don't actually see themselves on the screen. They are living sort of vicarious black male hero fantasies, and they grow up and they go to college and they get jobs and they grow out of it. But I'm much more concerned about young black kids who really see this as, well, that's me, and this is what, you know, my life plan holds, to be a thug and to, you know, to do all the silly stuff they see on videos, which is just, you know, basically not true, which is the other problem with gangster rap, which is its one sort of redeeming argument was that it's telling some kind of true tale from the streets. And it's just basically not true in most cases. Most of these rappers aren't living these lives. Many of them have never lived those lives. And if they had, they're certainly not living them now as musicians. So, you know, it doesn't even really have that to stand on, that, you know, in the early 90s, you know, it was at least, I think, slightly different.
Let's get back to the Boondocks. The two main characters, the brothers Huey and Riley, have moved to the suburbs with their grandfather. And why did you have the two boys being brought up by their grandfather?
The boys are brought up by their grandfather because I felt if they were brought up by their parents, the parents would be a little too hands-on. And having, you know, the grandfather whose attitude is, you know, well, now that I've gotten you into a nice neighborhood, I basically, you know, you have nothing to worry about and I can just watch television all day. It was meant to sort of allow the boys to sort of have to, you know, encounter the neighborhood on their own with not as much sort of parental supervision or oversight than they would have if their parents were actually there.
I want to ask you about the first strip that's featured in your new collection of the Boondocks.
Well, it was the first strip that ran.
Oh, it was the very first strip that ran. Okay, so yeah. It's the two brothers. They've just moved to the suburb, and the older brother, Yui, is saying to the younger kid, well, you know, we're not on the hard streets of the Chicago South Side anymore. And the younger kid, Riley, the kind of kid who wants to really be a thug, he's saying, yeah, and that means I'm the hardest, baddest thing for miles, and I can run amok here without fear. So, you know, to the young kid, it's just an opportunity to, like, look tough and to assume that the other kids in the neighborhood are going to think he's tough. What are some of the things that you were drawing on in thinking about that strip?
You know, the strip you're talking about is the idea that, you know, there's a certain lack of understanding here with first of all, Huey and Riley, being so different, often fail to communicate effectively even when they're talking to each other. But, you know, in particular, Riley is looking at the new neighborhood from a sort of gangster mentality, which means, oh, everyone here is soft. And it's an opportunity for me to sort of, you know, come in and take over the place. You know, most of gangster rap culture comes from Scorsese movies or you know, Scarface, Godfather, or Casino, Goodfellas. And so there's this sort of, you know, larger-than-life attitude as though, you know, these people are, any of these people could do something like that or be Scarface or be Robert De Niro in Goodfellas in real life, which, of course, they can't. It's part of what the critique of gangster rap is about, which is, you know, you're not Cuban, you're not Colombian. You know, you're black and you live, you know, in a poor neighborhood and you sell drugs in the corner. You're not a mob boss. You're not a don. And you know, most of you probably have never even sold drugs in the corner. But it's a fantasy that was created by white America. And white America did such a wonderful job romanticizing the mob that they then turn around and be surprised when young black America emulates that. You know, we watch the same movies everyone else does, and we like the same actors as everyone else does, and we like the same directors as everyone else does. Only, you know, so many of us live harder lives that the idea of the sort of dashing criminal is much more appealing to try to act out in real life than it would be to white America that has many other opportunities.
I know what you're saying about that. On the other hand, like before the Scorsese movies, there were movies like Superfly that, you know, also had that real like gangster image and a lot of like guns and drugs and.
But there was a difference.
Money. Yeah.
There. Well, yes. I mean, the Blaxploitation era is. I think we see elements of that. I mean, but there was a difference, which is, you know, the Blaxploitation era had heroes. I mean, Shaft was a good guy. Mm-hmm. Coffee Brown, you know, the Pam Grier movies.
Right.
Yeah, there were bad guys and there were good guys. And there was also a very sort of a political sort of pro-black, you know, slant to a lot of it as well. I mean, yeah, there were a lot of pimps and there was Dolomite. And but even someone like Dolomite was in a lot of ways a sort of hero. You know, it was all about, you know, giving it to the man, so to speak. And, you know, while certainly we see the influence of Blaxploitation in hip-hop today, it is not the same as The Godfather or Scarface, particularly Scarface.
Now, you say in the introduction for your new collection that if it wasn't for September 11th, the strip would have probably ended in 2002. Why?
Because I was just burnt out. You know, I'm not a performer. You know, I'm never there when people read the strip. So, you know, to me, it's a very small thing. I do it. I send it to my editor, and then that's it. I'm on to the next week. So there's no sort of there's no immediate gratification. It's not like standing on stage and telling jokes and seeing the audience respond to it. Also, it's an incredibly difficult job, which was sort of starting to wear on my health, and I just wasn't really happy. I mean, it's just brutal, and many cartoonists work for years before they're syndicated and have time to sort of, you know, find out if this is what they really want to do. And I sort of did 30 strips in college and then went straight into international syndication. And it, you know, it was a heavy adjustment those first couple of years. And I think what changed with September 11th was it felt as though the strip would actually have a purpose, have sort of a reason to exist beyond just sort of telling jokes about Puffy and BET and all that stuff. And also it was material. You know, there was something to talk about now. There was something that was going to allow me to write the strip for 6 months without a tremendous amount of effort. And, you know, and the fact that I think, you know, so many people responded so positively to what I did after September 11th made it seem worthwhile to continue doing it.
What was your most controversial strip in the period just after September 11th?
It's tough to say because, you know, for 6 weeks it was banned in New York. There was the one where Huey calls the terrorism tip line attorney Ronald Reagan for funding Osama bin Laden in the 80s. And that one, I guess, started what would be 6 weeks of the strip being banned in New York. So I kind of look at that one as the most controversial. But I don't know. I mean, I did a lot of stuff for about a year after that, you know, a lot of people just didn't like. I mean, there was one strip where Huey was making reference to the German official who compared Bush to Hitler. And, you know, made note that Hitler was actually democratically elected, unlike Bush. You know, there was a bunch of stuff. I mean, I was having a good time and just trying to say things that I realized needed to be said, but that nobody else was going to say.
Did you think at all maybe you should tone things down a little bit out of respect to New Yorkers who lost so many friends and family?
These people died because the federal government, amongst other things, was asleep at the wheel. No, I don't see how it's at all respectful to allow the government off the hook for its responsibility in what happened on September 11th. And that's what's so scary about this country. We feel as though for some reason at the most critical moments in history that we should sort of give up our right to speak freely and say what we feel. And it's a very scary thing. You know, I think about the Iraq War and how when it started and everyone thought it was going to be over quickly, we paraded the dead around all day on television like they were these great heroes. And we couldn't, you know, I mean, it just went on and everyone got shot in the finger, you know, got on television. Now we've got at least, an average of 10 soldiers being wounded a day and one or two being killed a day. We don't see them because now it's gotten ugly. And now that's considered a buzzkill. Like, you know, hey, you're bringing us down. You're focusing on the negative. Like these soldiers' lives are somehow less important, or their sacrifice is less important than the ones that got wounded or died early in the war. It's sick. It's just really perverted.
The older brother in the Boondocks, Huey, is named after Huey P. Newton of the Black Panther Party.
Mm-hmm.
When you were growing up, did you wish that you had a kind of galvanizing political cause to be part of?
Well, look, there is a galvanizing political cause. It's just no one's galvanized. I mean, it's not as though black people in this country have it good or there aren't enough causes to fight. It's just no one's fighting them. I don't, you know, romanticize struggle. Struggle is what it is. I'm not going to sit back like a lot of people and wish I was a member of the Black Panthers. The Black Panthers were murdered and exiled and killed in jail. That's not cool. We had a lot of struggle where black people died young, and that's why we didn't win those struggles. There's no point anymore in going to jail for a cause, because it doesn't mean what it used to mean. There are no cameras there. No one's going to remember. There's just, you know, that is what I look at. That's a sort of outdated mode of fighting. What I want to see is I want to see people fight, but I want to see people fight in a way that's going to bring about a victory.
My guest Aaron Magruder writes and draws the syndicated cartoon strip The Boondocks. His new collection of strips is called A Right to Be Hostile. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest Aaron Magruder is the creator of the syndicated cartoon strip The Boondocks. He has a new book of Boondocks strips called A Right to Be Hostile. There's a strip in which I forget which character it is, but I think it's one of the brothers' friends is watching Fat Albert for the first time based on the Bill Cosby character,
mm-hmm.
and he's really disappointed. I mean, he doesn't like it. And he doesn't see what all the fuss is about. And I guess I'm wondering if you had that reaction when you were growing up to any of the pop culture that your parents or relatives, older relatives, really loved, but it just wasn't working for you.
You know, not really. I think the Fat Albert strips were to me just really sort of going back and looking hard at that show because so much of the stuff that we love from the 70s, my generation, we love it out of nostalgia's sake, whether it's Good Times or Fat Albert or whatever. And it's hard to shake nostalgia, but you go back and look at it and you go, wow, a lot of this stuff was incredibly offensive. What's particularly interesting about the Fat Albert thing is that it's Bill Cosby. And Bill certainly likes to take a holier-than-thou stance, particularly with regard to what young black kids are doing today. And again, it's not like there's not room for legitimate criticism because I criticize what young black kids are doing today all the time. But it's just really interesting to go back and look at what he did back in the day, which if it were, seen today for the first time, I think would be incredibly offensive to the sensibilities of average black people.
What do you think would be offensive?
Well, look, it's Fat Albert, Dumb Donald, Weird Harold, Mushmouth. I mean, there was the interesting thing on the Emmys where, Wanda Sykes asked him about the difference between what he used to do and what black comedians are doing today. And Cosby said very coldly, well, we used to speak English. And I thought, well, gee, not really. I mean, if you look at Mushmouth, I mean, look, when people make fun of how black people talk, they're doing Mushmouth. For the most part, they're not cute kids. They're not particularly smart kids, as indicated with Dumb Donald. They don't speak particularly well, like Mushmouth. They're grossly overweight. There's just, it ain't exactly the most uplifting show.
Do you have a favorite TV series from when you were growing up and had a lot of time to watch TV?
That's a good question. I there was a bunch of shows I liked. I used to love the Peanut specials. I think that more than anything, it's really why I'm doing what I'm doing. Those, the Halloween special and the Christmas special, those were just great. TV shows, man. We did watch Good Times and we watched What's Happening. And we watched the black shows and, we liked them. We also watched... Gosh, that's an. I'm trying to think back to what the heck I was watching when I was a kid. it's funny when you're older. Shows that seem like they were on forever really weren't on for very long. I remember it seemed like Battlestar Galactica was on for like half my childhood. It was a show that we really loved, me and my brother. But it was on for like a season and a half, maybe like two seasons at most. We watched Transformers and some of the cartoons that were on. When we were a little older, obviously, like everybody else, the Cosby Show was a big, big deal. And Family Ties and Cheers. And then later, you had Married with Children, which I thought was a really, really good show.
Some of like hip hop culture is about like having your posse, having like your people who you can like travel with and be with and so on. The work you do is so solitary, sitting alone at home and drawing a strip.
Yes, I have no posse.
I
have no people.
But does solitary work suit you?
Yes and no. The isolation of being a cartoonist, I think, is a problem even to those cartoonists who are not into hip hop. It's just a very, very lonely job. Nothing in Hollywood is as difficult, in my opinion, as being a cartoonist. It's all this stuff is easy after that.
Why is being a cartoonist harder?
Because it's completely on you, and it never ends. It's like I think it's Sysyphus, I believe, was the guy that has to sort of push the boulder up the hill and then mm-hmm. it keeps rolling down.
Mm-hmm.
I may have screwed up the name, but point is, it's that sort of never-ending burden, and you work incredibly hard to get something done, and then you get it done, and then you got to do it all over again, and it never ends. It's a very, very difficult job, and most of us do it all by ourselves, which makes it more difficult. It's, at the end of the day, it's much easier to yell at somebody else for screwing up than to be angry at yourself for screwing up. It's just physically much more damaging when the burden is all on you and you're beating yourself up week after week.
So when you're feeling kind of dry, what do you do to get ideas?
Panic. Uh-huh. I mean, there's no easy answer. I mean, again, it's part of why the job is so difficult. When you're doing it alone and you everything has to come from you and it's not there, there's nothing to do but panic as the clock ticks and the deadline approaches.
Now, you have a deal to turn the characters in Boondocks into both a TV serial and a movie. So what's your role in the TV series and the movie?
I'm an executive producer, meaning that, on the creative side, I'm the boss. Now, doesn't mean much to the network or the studio, but at least with the writers and the artists, I'm the boss. And I'm writing the pilot now, and I'll be, I think doing a lot of writing on the series, I'm just basically the guy in charge, and it's a very different thing.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Absolutely, thank you.
Aaron Magruder writes and draws the syndicated comic strip The Boondocks. His new book is called A Right to Be Hostile: The Boondocks Treasury. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.